You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Father, thank you that we can gather on Lord's Day. We can worship, hear the word, take the sacrament, remember your promises to us, and we ask a blessing as we reflect on our spiritual ancestors, Israel. In Christ's name, amen. Well, good morning, and it's good to see you, and thank you for coming to my class. This is the third in a four-part series. We're going to wrap it up next week. And let me just briefly kind of tell you where we've been to get to this part, because I know as it goes, we can sometimes come and go to these lessons and such. First, we talked about Israel as a people. God spoke. God spoke in history. That's what we know. That's all we know. We don't have any premonition that this is going to happen. We have no way of seeing this. It's simply a command. It's a call. And out of this small little corner of where Babylon, Persia, with modern Iraq and Iran, a man named Abram is called with his family, first to Haran and then down to the area of now Palestine, that area down in there. And this begins the movement of a people. It begins the movement of a promise in history, in space and time. God speaks, and Abraham accepts the speech in faith. Abram, and his name is changed to Abraham, of course. And with that, the promise is inaugurated. And to that promise are tied it was an unconditional promise, right? This isn't the law. It was an unconditional promise. You will be blessed, and you will be a blessing, okay? You will be blessed. You will be a blessing. You will have offspring. You're going to have these children that are going to come from you, and you're also going to have land. You're going to have land. Last week, we looked at the people. As we move from the promise, how do we move to a people, an identifiable group? And here, we looked at the sort of uncomfortable issue of circumcision, no pun intended, but it was because it is a difficult topic, but as a mark, right, as a way of designating. We looked in depth, a little bit of depth at that, as the establishment of a way of knowing the people, right? And then we looked at the giving of the law as not just the establishment of a people, but a people as a nation. That Jewish theology, rabbinical theology, understands the giving of the law as where Israel as a nation begins, okay? And that's what identifies it as Israel as a national presence. And it's a modern word, it's a modern term, but it makes sense, right? A political entity, perhaps, the law and the rituals that go with it. Today we're going to talk about the tabernacle and the temple briefly as we move to our third subject, which is the land. So a promise of people. Now we have a place, the land. What is the land? This, of course, the other two we could certainly say are disputed, but not as much as this one, as recent events have shown us, and I guess most of our lives have shown us for that matter. So we're going to look at Israel place. We'll wrap up next week with reflections on Paul in Romans 11 and what he says about Israel and the promise and how it relates to the church. But then also, just for the sake of keeping with the theme, a postscript, right? What is Israel today? We're gonna look at that. So let's talk about Israel, a place. Okay. The land of Israel. Yes. The land of Israel. Israel is known by a number of names, including in the Bible, it's referred to as Canaan. I'll say more about that. Eretz Yisrael, Zion, are simply ha'aretz, which means the land. All of them are used to designate the actual geographic space that we're calling Israel. And as you work through the scripture, you'll see that what we're talking about is an actual territory. It varies. It's never, if you'll allow me, consistent. We don't have a consistent sort of latitude, longitude, sort of boundaries that say this is what it is on a map. What we have is variations throughout the Hebrew Bible that tell us. And there's the big four, I think, worth isolating are Genesis 15, Exodus 23, Numbers 34, and Ezekiel 47. So over the next few minutes, let's just take a second and take a moment and let's look at these. Let's start with Genesis 15, and you'll see what I'm talking about as we press through this, that what is it exactly? On that day, the Lord, in Genesis 15, the Lord makes a covenant with Abram. He says, to your descendants, I give this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Raphaites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. Yeah, you got that? All right. Abram knew who they were, apparently. All right, so what is this? Well, I'll pause and just say, before we go further, that in current political turmoil, this is these tribal peoples, these ancient tribal people of the Near East, some Palestinians claim that this is their, these are their ancestors. That's why this land is theirs, okay? Yeah, so we're going way back with these claims. This is a rough, I don't know how well these will do here, but this is a rough idea of where these people groups were, if you were to overlay them on a map. The Kenites, the Jebusites, you see the Canaanites, Perizzites. The three that they can't seem to locate or figure out are these guys here. But just, again, for a visual purpose, that prior to Abraham's inheritance of this land, this is roughly based mainly on material evidence, archaeological evidence, where scholars of the ancient Near East think these tribal groups were. Now, obviously, you go back here, the Wadi of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. Now look, I wasn't great at geography, but you don't have to be. I'll help you. That's a huge territory. That's a massive territory. The Wadi is down here, and there's the Euphrates. There's Turkey. There's Europe. Yeah. And this is what, this is, if you were to overlay on a contemporary map, this is what that passage describes. And we all know that's not what we know of as Israel. Okay. Next, Exodus 23. Under Moses. I will establish your borders from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, from the desert to the Euphrates River again. I will give into your hands the people who live in the land, and you will drive them out before you, the tribes we just mentioned, all the Zites. Well, guess what? That doesn't help us much because we're kind of back to this map again between Genesis and Exodus. All right, massive territory. How'd you like to go to the United Nations with that map and say, yeah, I wouldn't. Okay, Numbers 34, 1 through 15 is the next passage we're isolating here, the tribal allotment. So here we move from the promise to sort of some specifics. We start naming names, the tribal allotment. And here we have mention of the land of Canaan for the first time. Okay. Well, actually, I'm not sure if it's the first time, but it's the land is designated as you're going into the land of Canaan, okay? And if you remember, which I just know everybody knows this off the top of their head, Canaan was the son of Ham, right? And there's the curse of Ham in the Bible in Genesis 9 after Noah gets drunk and then whatever horrible things happen there. But the curse is not actually on Ham. It's on his son. The curse is on his son. Noah indirectly curses Ham through Canaan. Scholars debate what actually happened, but it wasn't good, whatever happened there. So Jewish tradition refers to the region as Canaan this is what it's known as between the flood and the Israelite settlement of the tribes here. That's what they call Canaan, okay? So again, you're seeing that we can get confused in the names, we can get confused in the maps, because look at this map. There you see the tribes, Judah, Simeon, Judah, Dan. I won't read them all, but you see them there. And then, of course, you have the ones east of the three, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, all are on the Transjordan side. Once again, if you look at that carefully, it doesn't correspond with a map of modern Israel. And it certainly doesn't correspond with this, right? But yet it's here in Numbers that this will be the division of Canaan. Okay. Ezekiel. We're in a whole different world now, in the world of Ezekiel, right? This is the period of the exile. Ezekiel is one of the strangest books you'll ever read in your life. The way angels are described, they don't look like your manger scene angels, right? Ezekiel is a book of prophecy. It's a book of prophetic vision, and it's an exilic book. And it's one of the central themes, of course, is the restoration, right? The restoration and then the rebuilding of the temple after Babylon, right? After they come back, Israel comes back. We'll talk about the exilic period more in just a moment. The point here is, what does this have to do with the land? Well, in this vision of Ezekiel, he defines the borders of the land where the 12 tribes will live in the final redemption, the end of days, okay? We could probably debate what that means in a lot of ways, but in this particular case, it does have an eschatological horizon, but I think it also has a very contemporary. Israel's just going to return, and the temple is going to be restored. And the territory by these borders is actually divided into strips for each of the 12 tribes. So you really see a parallel with Numbers, what happens in Numbers. They're different but similar. And these strips, I'll show you in just a minute, in Ezekiel's vision, they include the whole of contemporary Lebanon, both the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Israel, okay? And small areas of Syria are included. This is a kind of, so you see the overlap with what we see in Numbers. If you were to actually kind of draw it, these would just, everybody, there's an equal sort of distribution amongst the restored Israel. The boundaries include the whole, well, I just told you that. But the other differences from when the land is reestablished in Ezekiel, resident aliens are invited to share in the tribal holdings. You don't see that in the early passages about the land. And there's equalization. There's this kind of symmetry between all the strips of the land. And Jerusalem is given a new name. Yahweh is there. Yahweh is present. Okay, so what is this? Four different sort of, we're isolating this, but it kind of gets at it. What's going on in the Old Testament, in the Torah, Hebrew Bible, that we don't have, like I tried to tell you, we don't have somebody, a cartographer who comes out and draws this up and says, this is what it is, right? And then, just to complicate it more, 9 times the settled land is referred to as from Dan to Beersheba. Okay. Here's Dan, the tribe of Dan settlement. And there's Beersheba. That's not a huge space. What does that mean? Right? What does that mean exactly? From Dan to, are we speaking in metaphor? Is it poetry? How is the language being used? And then three times, the land is referred to as from the entrance of Hamath unto the brook of Egypt. Kings and Chronicles. Well, Lebo Hamath, do you see that at the top up there? That's Syria. That's modern Syria, right at Syria, Lebanon. And then nobody really knows where the Brook of Egypt is. It's there, I suppose, right? So we don't really know. But obviously, again, what does that mean, right? How are we to talk about the land in this regard? Well, regardless, what we can take away, obviously, is the significance, right? I mean, clearly, like the establishment of a promise to the people, the land is enormously significant. And in fact, really, to understand Jewish thinking correctly, you have to understand the law and the place of the law and their identity. But this is, if not right along with it, an important, it's right there. What does it mean to be tied to the land? And here, when you start pressing into Jewish thought, you begin, just sort of Jewish theology, you begin to see different views about the importance and how they hold it. There isn't shocking, right? Like we don't have consistency in Christianity, neither do does Jewish theology. For some Jews, the relationship to the modern state of Israel is an essential part of the religious identity. It is a key to understanding Judaism. It is a necessary part of the religious culture of being a Jew. For some, as you can see, the connection is sort of cultural and personal. Religion isn't as central. It's more of a personal identity, to hold a connection to Israel. A very small minority do not see the land as important to their understanding of what it means to be Jewish. Very small minority. And there are some Jews who feel that Israel should never have been set up as a state in 1948, before the coming of the Messiah, because exile is a punishment from God. That's not a majority either, but it's worth mentioning, right, and noting as we reflect on this. So it's hard to know what it is geographically. We know the significance, at least, of the idea remains, and the land. There is a topography. There is a thing there called Israel, in history. Okay, but we also have different interpretations within Judaism as to what it is or what it's supposed to be. By far, the dominant interpretation is it's part of our identity and religion. Okay. Another way to get at Jewish understanding of the land is language itself. Okay, in the words of the scriptures, this is from Genesis 15, on the day that the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land." Well, in Jewish theology, the Hebrew is incredibly important. The word is natati, and it's from the word nata, but it's in the past tense. So you've got to think, why is this man Abraham being told in the past tense as opposed to "I am giving" or "I will give," "I have given"? And for a number of rabbinical Jewish scholars, this indicates that at some earlier time, this from creation, frankly, as it says on this, from creation, from the created order itself, the land was given. It was intended to be for the people of Israel at the time of creation. Abraham is simply getting the first recorded promise of the land, right? So the belief is that Israel was set aside as part of the created order itself, and Jewish rights to the land are eternal, therefore, and unconditional. Okay. The history is rough, right? It starts in the Bible, and when we get to Chronicles and Kings, the divided kingdom, and then, of course, conquest and exile, right? As to actually what happens, we know Israel does not have consistent holding of the land. In fact, they fight over them between themselves as to what they're going to do with it. Part of their history, right? And in this sense, you simply just can't understand Israel as a place. You have to understand Israel as a way of imagining itself, of its self-understanding. And here we need to talk about exile and exilic theology for just a moment. Okay? Galut, gola, exile, exilic, to be exiled. It is a Jewish conception. And it's more than just a word, like I am exiled, I've been cast out. It is a way of remembering and a way of thinking, okay? That the condition and feeling that of being uprooted from your homeland and subject to alien rule, okay? And the term itself essentially applies to the history and historical consciousness of Jewish people from the Second Temple period to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. And it is found throughout the Middle Ages. It's found throughout the early modern literature. We'll see in a moment, it is part of the practice of being Jewish, is to understand the land in terms of exile, the place in terms of exile. And then there are more exiles in the Second Temple. I'll show in just a second. But it was after the Second Temple, the destruction of the Temple, that really, even before that with Babylon, the question of what Galut is becomes part of the Jewish theological vocabulary. Okay? And let's just do some history. There are four exiles to keep in mind. Some would say there's a fifth, that would be when they went down into Egypt. But I didn't put that up here. So, four exiles of the Jewish people. The first is the Babylonian exile. That's followed in the Bible, right? Only the Persians come in and conquer the Babylonians, right? And that's when we get the sort of intimation that the Jews will be able to return and rebuild the temple under Cyrus, right? Under Persia. Then you have a Hellenistic conquest under Greece. Okay, and when the Greeks conquer, the Greeks were terrible conquerors. The Romans were really good at it. The Greeks were terrible at it. They would go in and they would set up these sort of, I don't know, vassal states. The Seleucids is what they're known as in history. And basically, it just Hellenized locals who then created their own kingdoms and dynasties. But then, this is known as the Hasmonean period. In Israel, and then we know the Romans because they get all the headlines. They came in, and the Roman exile is believed by some to not have ended until 1948. so we're within the range there, right? Okay, why do we have to, if you can take a promise with you, you can take circumcision with you, you can even talk about the law. Why do you have to have a place that you know, an actual geographical boundary? Well, I think that's where we have to appreciate that it's not just the place, it's what's supposed to be practiced at the place, right? It's the law that's tied to, way back, the tabernacle, right? And then the temple, okay? So it's not just that you have the promise. It's in the Old Testament, you're given, as a Jew, a sacrificial order of things, of reality, in terms of how you're going to relate to Yahweh. So two things are part of this galut, this exilic sort of longing, right? The tabernacle, and then later the temple. The tabernacle is issued in Exodus 29, where he tells the Israelites to consecrate this tent of meeting, and then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. Okay? They will know that I am the Lord their God who brought them out of Egypt, so that I might dwell among them. So now we're getting the promise tied to the actual presence of God in a place and a practice. Okay? And then here's a sketch this up this morning for you. I found this. This is what supposedly the tabernacle. There actually is a way it is supposed to be set up when they set the camp up as they wander before entering into the promised land, with the tabernacle at the center and the various tribes having their stations around it. Some say a circle, some say a square, a rectangle. That's an original drawing. I don't know where that came from. And then you have the temple, right? The temple itself, which it replaces the tabernacle. It becomes, the word of the Lord comes to Solomon. You're familiar, right? The temple you're building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws, keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will, here you go, live among the Israelites and not abandon my people Israel. Big promises. Right? And here, of course, this is in a museum in Jerusalem. This is what you may have seen, these mock-ups of what the temple looked like after it was rebuilt. It's believed this is what the Solomonic temple actually looked like before it was destroyed in 70 AD. Okay. So we got a place, now we got a practice, and we got now the promise has gone from to the presence. I'm nailing it with the P's. The presence, right? You actually have the presence of Yahweh, the presence of the Lord with the people in this place, in this practice. Okay. Now, the temple is destroyed twice in Jewish history. The first destruction was under Babylon, the Babylonians, and it is rebuilt. When the temple is rebuilt, we know it as the Second Temple period, and it's the Second Temple period in practice that Christianity emerges under that time period, and it's the Second Temple that the Romans destroy, right? Okay. It's the Second Temple, and today, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it translates the furthest mosque, sits on the Temple Mount, as Jerusalem is divided into, you know, under four quarters by international regulation. If the furthest mosque is believed where Muhammad, I think it's book 17 in the Quran, the night journey of Muhammad. You read up on that one. Muhammad travels from Mecca to Jerusalem, and it's believed, actually, in the Quran, it's Christ who tells, it's Jesus, Christ to us, who says that this is why this should be a sacred place in Islam. Jesus is the prophet who sees this. So, yep, that sat there, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. All right, so the problem of galut, the problem of exile, as it is tied to the land, which we've already seen, is very hard to figure out what the borders are. But we're starting to also see that whatever this promise is, it's moving in the Bible. It's unfolding. Something is happening. Jews, though, if you're Jewish, you never leave galut. It is built into your calendar. It's built into your prayers. Virtually every aspect of religious routine in life is tied to the theme of Israel and exile and remembering. So as you know, and I don't mean to be redundant, but Jews face Israel when they recite daily prayers. Orthodox Jews do. We're going to talk more about those divisions next week between Reformed, Orthodox, Liberal, etc. Praying to return to Zion is part of a standard blessing. Jewish meals. I have Jewish friends. I've heard it. Maybe you have too. And the Seder meal and the High Holy Day service conclude with the words next year in Jerusalem, right? You may have heard that with friends as well. So it's there today. It is there to this day. And this restoration, this ingathering of exiles, it is at the heart of their redemptive understanding that the Messiah will come. Why is the Messiah going to come? Because the land is restored and the temple is restored. And this is the prerequisites for Messiah returning. Every year at the Tisha B'Av, I think it would probably be more accurate. It's usually in late July or August. There is a fast. There is a fast commemorating the first and second temple's destruction and the exile. And then, you know, if you've been to a Jewish wedding, right? What do? You break the glass, right? I never really understood what that was about. It looked kind of cool to do it, I guess, even as a Gentile, just throw something on the ground. But it's the theology behind it is that even at this most happy of celebrations, the union of a man and a woman, a new family, a new life, at the height of personal joy, you have to remember sorrow and destruction. And that symbolic of the temple being destroyed when that glass is thrown down. So even at your happiest of moments, you are to remember what happened. And then there is a mystical tradition within Judaism that actually teaches the air you breathe in Israel makes you a wiser person. The land will refuse to bear fruit unless the Jews are its natural caretakers and those for whom it was created dwell on it. It's serious, right? It's not something you can simply shrug at once you get in the weeds on this. We know it's serious. We know it is. It's meant to be taken seriously, and we as Christians should think of this and respect it seriously. Tied to the land and tied to the practice of temple and law and tied to exile, tying all this together, three factions emerged under the Hasmonean period. So you remember for the test, the Hasmonean period was the Greeks, okay? It was the descendants from the Greeks. And they were kind of a prop puppet government that was set up there in the territory of Palestine. And the three factions, you've heard of these, are the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, right? We've all heard of these guys. They're probably older than this period, at least the beginnings of the kind of practices they initiated, but they really came to prominence in the Second Temple period after the loss. And so the Pharisees had the main characteristics in the belief that the oral law, that there is, along with the written law, the code of Sinai, the revelation, there is an oral law that goes along with the Torah, the Talmud, right? The tradition of interpretation. And that the written law is open to interpretation, and to be clear, their interpretation. This is the ancestor of the rabbinical tradition. The Pharisees are the ancestors of the rabbinical tradition. They came from the common people. They were the middle class, okay? They were not part of the aristocratic elite. And it is their practices which move into contemporary Judaism, of the way both the rabbinical tradition, but also the traditions of the synagogue. Okay. Sadducees are different. You may know, again, if you know this, forgive me, but it's worth mentioning that these are your aristocrats. This is your priestly caste. They were much more liberal in their willingness to integrate Hellenism or Greek practices into their customs, into their lives. The Pharisees were not. They reject the idea of the oral law. And instead, they hold to a literal interpretation of the written law. That's why they don't believe in an afterlife, because it's not there. There's no mention of a resurrection. They are, if you want to understand what they did, they were associated with the temple cult. These were the Sadducees, and they really kind of disappear from the record after the second temple is destroyed. Finally, you get the Essenes, and I'll let you pick which one you're in of the three. But they emerge out of a disagreement with the other two. They believe that the other two practices had corrupted Judaism. And they go off to the desert. This is the famous Qumran community. The Dead Sea Scrolls come out of this group, and that's discovered in the 1940s. All right. Land, exile, law, temple. Now we got a community of teachers and scholars who are continuing it, right? Well, we wouldn't be true to ourselves, though. And this is where we're headed next week, as we press into some postscript reflections on what does this mean for the church. We're at church. We need to try to understand it. Hopefully this gives us some kind of paradigm, which we already have, but maybe expands it, about why it's so problematic to this hour, to this day. But we do have the words of Christ. We can start with the words of Christ to help us as we reflect and lead into reflections with Paul next week. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings? And were you not willing, behold, your house is forsaken, and I tell you, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then in John, the Samaritan woman has come up to Christ and said something about her husband, and then she kind of says, well, I actually have a lot of husbands. And Christ says, yeah, you've spoken truly now. And Jesus says to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountaintop nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. So the very words of Christ start pointing us in a bigger unfolding of a redemptive history, that the promise now in Christ is moving out from the Jews into the Gentile world. This, in the New Testament, is the great question of continuity and discontinuity. This is, beginning with the words of Christ, and really our first great theologian, Paul, becomes the project and task of Christian biblical interpretation, right? What do we do with this story? We now have a testament that says being tied to the land is no longer being tied to God's will in a salvific or redemptive sense. God's people are sent out to the nations and are called from the nations. The Gospels don't talk of the temple being destroyed as cataclysmic. It's an inauguration of something new. Pentecost, right? The creation of the church. And Gentiles are now welcomed as children of Abraham without needing to hold to practices that were the core distinguishing marks of Judaism: circumcision, the law, sacrifice, dietary rituals. All of that then becomes matters of discontinuity in the New Testament period. Do you have any questions or do you want to add anything? Yes, sir.
As a Christian Gentile, as a Christian, because what is the role of the United Nations to go help Israel to set the border and stop the Arabs to bother them? They are brothers because they came from the same father. So, if Israel was promised God promised them, you are going to be and receive the handy land. Why in the world we don't, the rest of the world, we support that and help Israel? Because whatever happens to Israel is going to affect the rest of us. And I want to ask you another question.
Oh, well, that one was so easy. Well, let me take it for. Yeah. So, as to your second question, I'd like to save that for next week and talk about the question of eschatology and how the Christian Church interprets the restoration of Israel in different ways. As to the first one, I don't have a good answer. I would be remiss to try to answer that if I'm honest. I'm a history professor at a small university, and this is much bigger than me, and I speak from a particular location and identity and citizenship. I don't disagree with what you're saying. It's just I think it'd be careless to try to answer that in a church right now. So, yes, sir.
What's interesting to me is the Brits would say east of Suez.
Yeah.
Is a different world.
Yeah.
Place and tribe have a great deal of influence even to this day.
Yes.
It's not so much a national identity as it is a place identity.
Yep.
And a familial or tribal identity. And that is woven into the life so much that we see these differences and these conflicts.
Yep.
As a result of us violating those or seeking to impose.
Yep.
Our thoughts and our geographic and demographic ideas on a people.
True. Again, next week I want to deal with some of those post-World War I issues and how the land was carved up. Yes, sir. And then I've got to go. I'm going to read Lessons and Carols.
Very quick question. A very quick point. We kind of laugh when we see Israel extending into Syria.
Yeah.
But it was only a decade ago at the start of the Syrian Civil War when there was still a Jewish community in Damascus that had been there the whole time and had not been in exile.
That's true.
That's true.
Thank you.
You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.